The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. That's the immortal opening lines of L.P. Hartley's novel The Go-Between, set in the early 20th century. And really, it's the essence of my next guest's approach to work and life. He's going to take us on some time travelling, as he describes it, to visit some of the people who've interpreted, shaped and connected us to the stories of our Australian past. The job of our historians, broadly understood, our guide being one of the best of them, Professor Tom Griffiths. Tom's given himself the tough task of selecting favourites among people who, as he puts it, cultivate wonder about different ages as a technical skill, who aim to live with the tension of being both astonished and understanding about our past all at once. And he's brought this all together in The Art of Time Travel, Historians and Their Craft. I'll let Tom Griffiths explain.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Look, I just have to read you from your prologue. Here's this double historical quest to be astonished as well as to understand. It's a tension that goes to the heart of the historical enterprise. I have never heard history described like that.
Yes, it's a fascinating challenge to write history that brings that tension to the fore, I think. But that feeling that it is connected to our present, that there are familiar things to be discovered there that we can identify with and we can draw on. But there's also, the past is a foreign country and you do have to time travel to a different dimension to see that difference.
And then imagine it. Many people listening, I suspect, will be admirers of some of the historians and writers you feature in the book. I mean, you've got Eric Rolls, you've got Henry Reynolds, Grace Karskens, who really opened our eyes to the history of people living in the rocks in early Sydney. But you've got people like Eleanor Dark, for instance. For you, what connects them all?
Great acts of the historical imagination. That's why there are novelists and archaeologists and mainstream academic historians, a poet is in there as well, Judith Wright, because history is an act of discipline and imagination, and it can be both. It can be both scholarship and art. And sometimes when we debate history, we push it into the dry, arid scholarship category.
Indeed,
and thereby,
we do.
You know, we deny the creative impulse that drives so many historians, that passion, that engaged citizenship, that literary art that enables them to write things we want to read.
Look, I have to say, I've been wanting to hear an historian say this for years and years, because I'm fascinated with history, and I've been appalled in many ways about the decline of history. Have you noticed this yourself? I know you don't want to comment on your own craft like that, but that's what I've thought.
Yes, I have noticed that, and I think we have to go back to that basic understanding that history is about true stories, and it's about telling true stories in a way that they are believable, because truth is really stranger than fiction, and you do have to do a lot of work and a lot of research to make that strange past believable and to enable it to come alive. Now, that doesn't mean that you're making stuff up. That means that you are within the bounds of evidence, transparently, moving into that past world, trying to see it in all its integrity, give it back its own present, give it back its own possibilities. But then you do have to come back to the present and speak to your own society. So that's the discipline and that's the art.
Well, the discipline part of it is obviously very, very important in your mind. Did you go to their own work to get their sense, and I'll quote you here, of how they scoured their own societies for vestiges of past worlds? How did you tap that?
Well, I knew or know all of the historians there, except for Eleanor Dark, but I had the fortune of working in her writing studio at Varuna in the Blue Mountains some years ago, so I feel that kind of a connection there. So in many cases, I did talk to the historians, but mostly I worked with their published body of work, and that itself was the challenge I wanted to give myself, to read holistically and sympathetically into their life work, and then to see how it emerged from their life experience. So, yes, I did draw on archives and unpublished materials from time to time, but chiefly, really, I was dealing with their published history, and that was what I wanted to do, because I am interested in history as a literary craft, and so I was working with the products of that.
The idea of really feeling the past, of understanding that history isn't just names and dates and lists, you illustrate all through the book how important that is. But I must say, I do love the story about when you were a young history tutor for the historian and anthropologist and ex-priest Greg Denning. Now, in a way, it seems to summarise a lot of what you're trying to say. I don't know whether you agree. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes, well, Greg was a very influential teacher of mine, and indeed of a whole generation of historians. He's one of the most influential historians in Australia. And Greg had, he was formerly a Jesuit priest. He had a priestly manner. He was charismatic and enigmatic. His silences were as powerful as his words. And I remember when I was an undergraduate in 1977 and studying his extraordinary course, Social and Reflective History, and sitting in the great Raked Lecture Theatre at Melbourne University, listening to him tell us about the history he was writing at the time, which was a history of Xavier College. And he had found a letter in the archive from a Xavier boy who had gone to the Great War. And the letter was written to the mother of a friend of his, and it was written just after this friend and the mother's son had died whilst he'd been hit by shrapnel whilst cooking breakfast for his mates in the trenches. And the letter was so heartfelt and so moving. And Greg decided to share it with us and to read the whole primary source. He was very moved in reading it as we were in listening to it. And when he got to the end, he just allowed this silence to exist. And he suddenly just gathered up his papers and walked out of the room. And this was just 20 minutes into a 1 hour lecture. He just walked out. And we're all left there, and everyone was left in silence. We sat in silence for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, wondering, is he going to come back?
And is he crying? Because you say that he did choke up a couple of times.
Well, yes, and I don't think he planned that. I think he was a great one for performance, and you know we have to perform our history and our stories. And I think he got to the end of that, and he thought, these words are so powerful. I am not going to dilute them with interpretation. I'm going to let them hang in the air, palpable, for these students to understand that, you know, history is not a game. It's very serious. We can be playful, and he encouraged us to be playful, but this, ultimately, it's about life and death, and it's about meaning. And it was a very powerful message.
Certainly, and it's certainly nothing dispassionate about that, is there? Because one of the things that I get from your book is that you do bring a lot of emotion to it, and I think the people you've chosen bring a lot of emotion. And a lot of us might think, oh, no, that predisposes you against being a good historian.
That's interesting. I am arguing against that case, yes, that one can be passionate and objective. That's something that John Mulvaney, one of the historians and archaeologists I study, has often said, and he is an exemplary, objective scholar of the deep past in Australia. But he's also a passionate scholar. And
doesn't make you subjective.
Well, it can. And that's, again, where the discipline comes in hand. You know, passion can take you into the past. It can open up. You know, you're connecting the past with your present. That dialogue is essential. But at some stage, you do have to rein in that passion, and you have to be as objective, and you have to work with that evidence, and you have to lay down the tracks of your evidentiary trail, you know, so others can follow in your footsteps and disagree with you. All those footnotes, they're not just scholarly pedantry. They're invitations to debate. They're saying, come on, follow my footsteps, disagree with me, challenge me.
Oh, God, that's a very interesting take on footnotes. I hate footnotes.
I love them.
Oh, do you? Oh, right, okay. Well, archives and the written word, in a way, this is what you're saying, they're paths to the past. But you've included this novelist, Eleanor Dark. Listeners might know her book, The Timeless Land, or they might have studied her novels at school. Now, why does she excite you?
Because she was writing The Timeless Land, which is historical fiction about the first 5 years of the British colonisation in Sydney. She wrote that in 1941, and she was 40 years ahead of the historians in terms of leaping across the other side of the frontier. And she did that with an act of disciplined historical imagination. Yes, she was a novelist, but she also researched for years in the Mitchell Library, and she imagined into the known past. So I begin the book there because she intrigues me. It was a very influential novel. It was possibly the most influential work of history in 20th century Australia. It was also very well known and admired overseas. And yes, she was a novelist, but she's also taking history very, very seriously. And when the book came out, She was very willing to talk about history and about the early years at Sydney. And she wanted to say she was disappointed in the celebrations of the sesquicentenary in 1938, and she felt that Aborigines and convicts and women had been forgotten. And she wrote a book which brought them right back centre stage. And The Timeless Land is both equally about Aboriginal society as it is about the white strangers who arrive.
My guest is Professor Tom Griffiths, and he's written a wonderful book, a very demanding in its own way book. It makes you think, in other words, The Art of Time Travel, Historians and Their Craft, and he's with me now. So how different is she to Inga Glendinnen, whom you also put as one of your people whom you've chosen, who I've always thought was just a fabulous contributor, in terms of her taking on, you know, the whole Kate Grenville controversy about her imagining it a secret river? What was different there?
Yes, so I do see them as related because I think Kate Grenville is also dealing in history very seriously, and she does make a case for a historical method, a historical method of empathy, of reenactment, of trusting your intuition, which is, I think, valuable to some extent. But Inga's argument with Kate Grenville is to say that, well, historians, it's a bit like what we're saying about passion and objectivity. Historians can be led into the past by intuition and experience to some extent, but there's a point at which you have to say, I cannot trust it. I have to retreat from that because I have to allow the past to be different, to be strange, and I have to recognise just what those different rules that operate in the past on their own terms. And so empathy can be very misleading. And Inga's work grew out of work on the Aztec culture. Mm. And she found herself dealing with that culture of human sacrifice in Aztec society, horrified by it, and feeling a complete lack of empathy in writing about that. And so she had to find some way of actually understanding that world without empathy. So historians learn to be very wary of empathy. There does come a point where you can't trust it because ultimately that is assuming the past is just like us. You know, it's people, as Inga and Greg would put it, it's people, you know, dressed in like us, dressed up in funny clothes. Mm. And that means it sort of flattens the experience of the past if you assume that they behaved as we do now or they felt as we do now, because they didn't. It was a different culture.
Even if you end up then sounding judgmental.
You can lead on to judge, but ultimately it is to understand. And in Inga's work, she wrote about the Holocaust. How do you understand the Nazi perpetrators of the Holocaust? Is that something that is a credible moral quest? She grapples with that.
So someone like the historian Grace Karskens, she's an interesting sort of, she fits in the middle, I suppose, of all this, doesn't she, in terms of her highlighting past Aboriginal experiences in a thoroughly revitalised way. Now, why do you like her work?
Oh, I agree. I think she's one of the best historians working in Australia today. And her book, The Colony, Early History of New South Wales, is just a stunning piece of work. It's such a compelling book to read. One of the things that she does is she does bring that feel of the past to the fore, the sensory world of the past. And it's because she is an archaeologist as well as a historian, someone who takes material culture very seriously, who's worked a lot as a public historian as well as an academic historian. And I think that sort of awareness of community, of oral history, of material culture, of archaeology comes through in every single sentence of her book. And she does bring the Aboriginal experience of early Sydney right into our consciousness and reminds us that Aboriginal people have been here, of course, from the very beginnings, even in our cities.
Well, that was to segue nicely, because you end the book with the work of an archaeologist. So we're really going back in deep time. You talk about the three layers of time with Mike Smith, and you describe Mike Smith's work as a quest to understand the dizzying abyss of human history in Central Australia. Great line. How significant is his work?
Yes, he's a very important archaeologist, and he's part of a team of a generation of wonderful archaeologists. We're so lucky in Australia that archaeologists have really made huge leaps in understanding, working now very closely with Aboriginal people, and we have Aboriginal archaeologists too. And Mike is known as Dr. Deep Time, and it's an affectionate term that reminds us that, in a way, the movement of the book from the Timeless Land to Dr. Deep Time, that is the discovery of the generation that I've grown up in, that, you know, we've suddenly discovered there's tens of thousands of years of human history here. It's a great inheritance, provided we are prepared to give dignity and respect to Aboriginal people today. And one of the things that impresses me about Mike's work is he's not just looking for old dates. He says in order to understand Australian human history, we have to have a detailed history over those 60,000 years, as much as we can, of change over time.
You do say, unless I'm misreading you, that in fact, contrary to our thoughts of us being shallow, shall we say, we've actually, in our historical community, we've gone exceptionally deep, and that this is being recognised around the world. I was really surprised to read that.
There's a lot of interest now in, well, this revolution in historiography in Australia, yes, worldwide. And I guess particularly as we're caught up in debates about climate change now, where we really do need some parables from the past about human societies that have survived major changes in temperature, rising of seas and so forth. We have that in Australian human experience and we have much to learn about it. But those stories are there for us to draw on and to draw strength from as we live in the land of, you know, the El Nino continent, the land of droughts and flooding plains. But we've also got this long history of humanity in this land dealing with cataclysmic environmental change.
Well, look, it's marvellous to discuss such an arc of history that you're describing here. Tom Griffiths, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Tom Griffiths is the W.K. Hancock Professor of History at the ANU, the Australian National University. His books and essays have won many prizes, including the Prime Minister's Prize for Australian History and the Alfred Deakin Prize for Advancing Public Debate. And this latest book, honestly, is one you shouldn't miss, The Art of Time Travel, Historians and Their Craft, published by Black Ink Books.